Remember, when it comes to this show, we want representatives of students from different continents so that we can share the diverse opinions that we have on issues. And so you can send us your messages on our Facebook page, Jinsekon Radio Show, or you can go to my Twitter page at Asamoah Peters or Instagram at Asamoah Peters and also give us your thoughts. Then we can read them out here. Okay, so you're going to start the show and I'm going to allow my guests to introduce themselves to you. And let's start from here.
Well, first of all, Kami, thank you for the invitation. My name is Luis. I'm from Nicaragua. That's in Latin America, Central America. And I'm 29 years old. I'm studying a master's in public policy and management here at Manchester University. And pretty excited to be here. So thank you for having me.
That's great.
Hi, I'm Sara. So I'm the Liberation and Access Officer at the Students' Union. I'm also a literature. I'm 22. I've moved around a lot. Like, I've spent most of my life in the UK. I lived in Canada for a while, which is why my accent has like a slime. I have like an Arab and South Asian background.
That's great. Our next guest.
Thank you, Kwame, for inviting me to this wonderful talk show. My name is Christopher Junior Rusina. I'm from Nigeria. So I'm a student of politics and sociology. I like to debate about political issues. So I'm very happy to be here today. Thank you.
That's great. Our other guests are on their way, and we are also very happy to have you. And I think the audience are thrilled, waiting for your views and your diverse views and your opinions on this topic. So today we are going to discuss nationalism and patriotism and how it could be a cause or solution to racism. And then here, we are not here to talk about the dictionary definitions of patriotism and all that, because we believe that people's personal definitions influence their actions. And so we really want to understand from your own perspectives what your contribution is going to be to this topic. So first, I want us to define exactly what racism is before we even go on to the causes. And I really want you to give us your personal definitions of it. So let's start with our brother here. Yeah. What's your definition of racism?
Well, Kwame, to me, racism is, first of all, it's pretty biased right now. That's number one. Number two, I think it's the general disregard of others. And I say that in the funny sense of others, because there are no others. Because of the color of their skin, their ethnical background, what they sound like, what they look like. And racism has evolved over the years, but we'll get into that a little bit later on.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So, Sara, do you have your own perspective on what racism is?
Yeah. So I think that oftentimes we think that racism is only skin color. To me, it's really, really important to recognize that racism, it's structural, it's institutional. I'm sure that we'll get into that a lot more later, because that's quite like a complex starting point. But I think it's really important. It's a deep structural oppression, not just.
Yes, and that is really important. The fact that it's complex is what sometimes the other person do not understand when you are telling the person you're being racist to me. So I think it's really, really great that you raised the point of it being complex, so we will delve much more into its complexity. So my brother here, Junior.
Thank you very much. Like, for me, racism is a very kind of an issue that presents itself in different forms. As you said, obviously, I've written a post about nationalism and patriotism. It's called "The Four Reasons Why Donald Trump Tweets to the Squad Was Racist." So, I explained there a little bit what racism is and how someone can be racist. A racist person is a primordial person. It is someone that believes that, for example, origin are being given by birth, so they are not something that a human being has invented. So if you are an African, that means that you've been born to be African forever. So you can't change your nationality to be maybe British or American. So that is what a racist person believe. And it is not true, because there is no kind of a pre-existing determination for a person's country. where you are born, where you are bred, it's not by force your nationality. You can move to another country and you can be naturalized. And a passport does not define a country. A passport defines your rights and obligation towards a nation.
So. Okay, well, that's interesting. I think it's even made the issue much more complex. So today, I want us to now delve into the issue. I want us to give us circumstances and issues that would make you as a person feel being like maybe experiencing racism. So I want us to really go down, giving us examples of what if somebody's to do to you right now will make you feel that you've had a racial attack. So let's start with Sarah.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess like there's a difference for sure between very like overt forms of racism, like hate crime and like violence. But at the same time, I think I would want to expand the definition of violence. I don't think that violence is just physical. So when I talk about racist violence, I do mean racist words, racist slurs, racist behaviors, treating someone differently from someone else. I think that's violence. I think deportation is violence. I think splitting families apart is violence. And from my personal opinion, I think that borders are violent because like borders result in exactly that, tearing families apart, refugee crises, border controls, all of this stuff. I think it's inherently violent. So yeah, I mean, I'm doing the whole thing again where I'm being like, yeah, I'm talking about the structure and the institution. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my personal experience, like I grew up in kind of like very much like a white middle class village in like the country in South Gloucestershire, and like my family came to the UK like pretty much just before 9/11, and the kind of like Islamophobic racism that we faced was very overt, like people egging our house, people spitting in our hair, like calling us Pakis, that kind of thing. It's been like a really, really long time since like that volume and that intensity of racism is something that I've necessarily experienced, especially after coming to Manchester. But there are still like the little things, and the little things chip away at you. Yeah. Like, you know, your English is so good for... They don't have to say it, do they?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope that's some form of an answer.
Yes, and I think one question I want to put to you is, do you think if a group, somebody is able to identify a trace of, let's say, behavior or attitude within a particular group of people, okay, is it fair for the person to use that to generalize or to predict the behavior of another person that he or she hopes to see?
I mean, no.
Because I think that has been the issue, that maybe a black man wearing a hoodie, especially a dark hoodie, is possible that he's a criminal. And maybe people have come across such situations a long time, and they felt that maybe those who were wearing it, those who were committing those crimes and all that, were black people wearing hoodies. So that's kind of asking that question, because I mean, we need to educate people around that. So what's your point?
Yeah, for sure. And there are so many levels of complexity there as well, because like this example that you've chosen, which I think is a really good example, I think specifically pertains to black men. Like young black men are seen by like white society as dangerous, and that's not just racialized, it's gendered as well. So like the way that black men and black women experience racism is different. The way I, as like an Asian person, as a Muslim, experience racism is different. As a woman, as a queer person, etc. So there are so many levels of like complexity here, and sometimes thinking about the way that racism is gendered or these kind of things also add levels to it, because you know, for example, obviously like I deeply, deeply believe in the Black Lives Matter movement, but there have definitely been black women who have said, why aren't we talking about black women being killed? Why aren't we talking about black trans women being murdered, right? We're having an epidemic of violence against black trans women. These issues are so incredibly complex, and race is something that's constructed in a particular way. Like, in a lot of ways, it isn't real. It's just... it's a system of signs and codes, you know, that we use to put people in a box, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah. So yeah, you want to add something to it?
Sure. I think Sarah's examples are exceptional in the sense that they cover a broad range of the manifestations of racism nowadays. I really want to add some of the historical background of this epidemic that's going on, and think about slavery, right? About 300 years ago. Think about segregation in the United States about 100 years ago. Think about all of the great, you know, advances that the world has made overall. But think about all the room still left to cover. And what I was going to say as a Hispanic, as a Latin American, there's this whole issue of stereotypes, like this idea is that we're not well educated enough, or that we're ignorant, that we're poor, that we're just made for the low skilled labor. You know, that's usually, like I said, a form of stereotype and a sort of racism expression in its way. And like I said in the beginning, racism nowadays is not as, like Sarah said, as institutionalized as it was with segregation or, you know, black and white drinking fountains. But it's, like I said, unbiased, even in elections. I remember in 2016 when Donald Trump won, nobody really gave 2 cents that he would win the election. And he won in an upset. That was a couple months after the Brexit vote. Nobody thought, or the majority of our generation did not think, that Great Britain would vote to get out of the EU. And still that vote happened. And so although I'm not saying that's racist in and of itself, I'm saying those are manifestations of biased forms of racism. You want to see the other person as different, as someone else. And that's where nationalism really comes in.
So, I mean, you've also raised a very, very, very good point. And coming back to Sarah's point around systemic racism, I just want to ask a question. Maybe, Junior, you talk about it. I remember applying for certain jobs when I came to this country, and it gets to a point where you're supposed to list the schools that you've attended, and they've already predefined the schools that you're supposed to select. Okay, so I get in there, and my bachelor's degree, I just could not find my school in there, and they didn't have the other option, you know, in quotes, other, so that you could put your school in there. So it's like literally I can't move forward because then I can't put my schools in there. So, Juna, to you, would you consider this as racist, like a racist way of, you know, getting a certain group of people who might have attended a school somewhere or are coming from a particular place not to be able to gain jobs in this country?
Yeah, I can really relate to that, Kwame, because it has happened to me as well, because I have had some studies in Nigeria. So definitely sometimes when you're filling from online, you don't have the possibility to include all your information because there is the pre-standard. So that is what I call standard institutional kind of biased general. You couldn't even define it racism, but I would say it is an institution barrier which some national. So I would classify it as a sum of nationalism, as he was pointing out before, because these are things, for example, like Donald Trump winning the 2016 United States presidential election, Brexit happening. So these are forms of nationalism whereby opportunities are given first to nationals rather than outsiders. So they predominantly put forward people that are born or that have schooled in the country before others who might be coming from outside. But at the end of the day, it goes against their legislations because, for example, in the Britain, there is the equality right that came out in 2010, which says that you have to give equal rights to everybody. It didn't mention only the British people. So you could see something like that, and I could say that it is an institutional barrier, which obviously the British people and that company has to be held accountable for it. Because such a thing, they can do it. Because under the equality right, everybody has to have the same access, the same possibility. If you're, for example, like myself in the country with a working visa, you should be able to allow to apply for jobs. So definitely I agree with you on that. And it is something that happened very often to international students.
Yeah.
whereby many international students are not able to get the jobs after they have spent a lot of money, studying for a bachelor degree or a master or a PhD, because they have been given only 4 months time to look for a job. And the same British policy says that companies must give priority to white British, black British, and South Asian British.
Yeah, I was about to come to that in relation to Sarah wanting to add a point to it, that, you know, I think in the law, like if an international student is to be granted a job by any company, the company needs to prove why a British person wasn't qualified for that job. And then, so you literally, every company, even when they are willing to sponsor, is supposed to prove to the government why they couldn't get a native or maybe somebody who is British for that job. Would you classify that also as one way of getting a particular race out of the equation?
Yeah, I 100% would. And I think that, Chris is definitely right to point out that this is like nationalism, but I would argue that it is also racist. I think it's a form of racist nationalism, because what we really have to ask ourselves when we see these things is, in what are people implying British means? Like, are they envisioning or imagining Britishness as white, as, you know, middle class, etc., etc.? And I think that's really important to highlight, because like international students and migrants, they face like a particular form of racism. But people who were born in this country face a different kind of racism, because they still aren't in kind of the national imagination part of this image of Britishness. And they never will be, because they're not white. They eat rice and peas, right? They don't eat fish and chips, which is like obviously like a load of crap. Fish and chips isn't even from Britain anyway.
They have the fish waters, but now they're getting it back with Brexit done.
And for the record, I'd have rice and peas over fish and chips any day. But so at the same time, I think it's important that, like, for example, like this Windrush drama that's happened recently is such a good example of how people who have spent decades in this country, who were born in this country even, are being denied the label of British. They still aren't seen as British. So I think the two are very much connected.
Great. So the question I want to also put to you to answer for us is, do you think there is a point in time where a citizen could say, I just do not need another citizen, another person from another race in my country?
No, and much less right now.
Not even a single time.
Well, in history, perhaps. I mean, when there was not when there were not airplanes or ships, but the world is so interconnected nowadays. It's so globalized. It's so integrated that you really need the skills of X, and you need the abilities, and you need the connections of Y, and the resources of this country, and the economic abilities of another country. So you really can do that. And to add to that, I would like to say, Kwame, that some of these surges of like Sarah said, unbiased or biased, I'm sorry, or implicit bias forms of racism are largely due to anxiety because of the uncertain future. So, you know, automation is taking over. Mm-hmm. You know, the machines are taking over. I did some research before coming on the show, and it seems that clerks, library keepers, people that are in the banks, their jobs are years away from being completely automated.
Yeah.
And so the less educated people will definitely face a huge challenge. And what's the answer of our politicians? Just to say, oh, it's the immigrant's fault. It's the different person's fault. But it's not really the root of the problem. The problem is education. That's the great equalizer. That's the only way that we can all be at parity. And, you know, in my view, you know, race does not play a card in that world when everybody's well-educated.
But I think you've raised a vital point, and maybe Junior would want to add something to it. My question is, you talked about technology and how it's going to affect jobs and all that. But you see, the origin of technology and whichever jobs is taken actually starts from the West. And so if they're able to create technology that just doesn't steal jobs from their own country, but also steal jobs from people from other races as well, then why should it be a problem for other races not to be able to come to their country because of lack of jobs and the lack of jobs being caused by technology that they developed? So, for example, let's say you are back to the banks. You've created a lot of systems that can allow computers to be customer service people. Yeah, so it will take some jobs here. But the point is you export those technologies into other countries. Okay, and then people in there also lose the jobs. So if they are able to feel like they can find some jobs in your country, why are you preventing them? Because you're making money from them. Junior, do you have any...
Yes, Kwame, it is a very complex issue that we are into right now because, you know, globalization is massive turn. Like, people see it as a positive thing, others see it as a negative. But generally, I view globalization as a very positive something. Like, this interconnection between everybody around the world is so much good for everyone. Like, I am able to learn a language right now just in few weeks with my computer, and it is incredible, and this is quite possible just because of globalization. And the other issue about jobs, for example, and he touched the question of autonomization and obviously robots taking over. I'm a politics and sociology student, and next week I'm starting a course in web developing because I know that if I don't do something like that in the future, I might not be able to guarantee a job. So we are moving forward towards the issue that some certain jobs have been they become redundant. You know, today you can play CD. You subscribe to Spotify. You subscribe to iTunes. You subscribe to Amazon Music. This is what is happening, and there is a particular people in any country that is not willing to accept these changes. You know, the blockbusters has lost billions because of online streaming. So are people willing to lose because of robot,
Junior, I think one thing that you're supposed to be looking at is that who started bringing in technology? Okay, so look at it from the race perspective.
Yeah.
Which race started bringing in technology as a solution to something? Okay, and then how is that affecting other people? So, for example, you brought in technology that does a customer service job, the blockbuster job and everything. But look at it from the point where you've exported it into other countries, making it easier for them to do this. But then those countries have been developed to the extent where they can take advantage of this. Yeah. And then the people lose jobs. But if they can find job in the Western world, any yeah. job that they can do, why shouldn't it be easy for people in that country to host these people? So maybe, I think Sarah wants to add something to it.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of off of what you have just begun to say. Like, personally, I think that technology is great. I think that making things easier for people to do is fantastic for many reasons. I think that the idea that technology is a huge part of the reason why people are losing jobs is slightly misleading, because I don't think it's inherently the technology itself. I think it's about distribution of resources, because, and I think it's like in a nutshell about global capitalism, because if like the 1% if the 1% took all of their money from their offshore tax havens and decided to fund social housing, they could with like a snap of their fingers. But they're making the decisions not to do those things. Like Boris Johnson and David Cameron and Theresa May are sat up all cozy with like their millions of pounds, which if they wanted to fund these things, help people get jobs, help people from industries that are becoming redundant be in like job transition programs and get jobs in other sectors, they could. For me personally, I think it's about capitalism. It's about the fact that we live in an economically unequal society, and unless those resources are redistributed to the people who need them and we don't have billionaires, I don't think we should have billionaires, then I think that that problem is never going to be solved. And I think that education is part of that, because for a lot of like working class people, who what they're seeing is, you know, I don't have any money anymore, I don't have a job anymore, and the Daily Mail is telling me that it's because of immigrants, so I'm going to believe that. For a lot of people, that is true. But there are educated racists, and I think that those are the people in power. People like David Cameron went to Oxford, right? And Theresa May, she probably went to Oxford too, I don't know. But she's rolling in it, and she's well-educated, but she's still a racist. And her policies have shown that for years and years. So I think that the economic structure that we live in is a huge part of this inequality.
Yeah. So,
yeah, just wanted to jump in real quick. This is the difference when you go to a great school or you go to an academic institution and you evolve in your tolerance, in your acceptance of others. So it's quite different to get a degree and to be actually mature. And I think you're right there, Sarah, but my point is that it's not the same to be a PhD than to be someone that's tolerant, that's inclusive, that's tolerant of other people, other cultures, other races.
Yeah. So I think the point that I also want, another point I want to bring across is that, look at, you are in the EU zone. You know, I think a lot of times explanations are being given using what we've learned. Okay, so maybe if you've learned something around economic integration, then you realize that, oh, okay, somebody within the Eurozone, the Schengen zone, can have free chance to move and everything. But then, like you're saying, we have walls. If you are coming from a particular, say, you know, it's been done rightly. Somebody from the Netherlands can come to the UK. Somebody from Germany can come to the UK easily, find a job, do the job without any problem. But why should it be difficult for somebody from Africa to easily come here and find a job and do it? That is where I want to find out whether we could also define that, even though it looks politically and economically some way, I don't understand why an African can't also pack the stuff and come here and find a job and just do easily like somebody from Germany.
Kwame, it is something that obviously it has to do with not just only racism, it has to do with nationalism and patriotism together. Because when you consider the EU bloc, it's a very, very conservative bloc. The EU looks like the most liberal bloc in the whole world, but it is very, very conservative. So that is why they like to keep the wealth between themselves. They don't want to share it. That is just the truth. And the British is one of the main reasons they are leaving the EU, is because British is a wealthy nation. It's the second, or if not the first, the most wealthy nation in the EU. And the current state of globalization and developing country, Africa is developing, Nigeria is developing, Ghana is developing, South Africa is moving forward, South Americans are developing, Mexico is developing, Brazil hosted 2016 Olympic Games, and South Asians, all those countries are developing, and they are going to become competitive. So the EU bloc won't allow them to compete with them equally. Allow an African person to come to the EU easily and to come and work is kind of giving them that kind of, freedom of competition. So allow them to compete equally. That is what they don't want.
But isn't that the case? Isn't that what they taught us, that capitalism is the best thing? But my whole question is, but why should somebody from Germany is able to come to the UK? Because the reason why we are trying to find out whether some of these things you're explaining contribute to racism, like somebody from Germany is able to come here, somebody from Poland can come here and all that.
It does.
Okay, so why is it that somebody from Africa can't also come here? Because the competition, the one from Germany too, is coming in with competition.
They see us as single-class citizens. That is what the EU nationals was complaining about. There has been multiple EU nationals suing the government, saying that the UK is treating them as single-class citizens. That is what they do, Kwame. They treat Africans and other people that are and other nationals that are not part of the EU as a second-class citizen, as so, people coming to taking their jobs to compete with them equally, and they don't want that. So that is the reason they won't allow African nationals to come to EU easily and compete equally with others. It's yeah. just
so Sarah. I think you want to have a point on that.
I think that historically and even now, Europe is a cultural kind of concept in itself. European history, European culture, European languages, etc. It's a concept within itself, because you don't have the English language or English history or English culture without immigration from, you know, immigration from Germany, or what we now know as Germany, from France. We wouldn't have the English language without Anglo-Saxon and French and Latin, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's something to be said for Western Europe being perceived as culturally superior to Eastern Europe. But even so, there's this very much, you know, colonial, imperialist, I would argue, idea of Europe as like the pinnacle of culture, you know. And I think that that's a huge part of why the EU bloc was ever a thing culturally. And I think that a lot of the tension with Brexit has been the fact that a lot of immigration was happening from Eastern Europe, where there's been a lot of strife, where people don't have a lot of money and they need to get away and find jobs. And Eastern Europeans are seen as inferior in a xenophobic way. That is, you know, slightly complex, and I'm not necessarily like the expert in that area. But a huge amount of the xenophobia towards Eastern Europe is what's led to Brexit. But there is definitely this idea of Western mm-hmm. Europe as being like the pinnacle of civilization, which.
And you know, like the question that comes to mind mm-hmm. that I wanted to add a voice to it. Okay, so exactly what would a country have that would make them think that they want to protect it so much that they do not need another race to come in? And then how does a different race really infiltrate or spoil a particular culture of, because you could, like what from what Sarah is saying, the culture of somebody, okay, regardless of the school that a person goes, keeps influencing a person's actions and everything. So even when a person becomes a president, most of his policies can't be driven by what he's been taught, what he or she has been experienced and all that. So exactly what is it about a particular country or its culture or something about it that would make them feel like, no, we don't need an immigrant, or let's not even say immigrant, we don't need a particular race to just come to this country and spoil it or something.
You know, I would say it's all in social attitudes. I'm not saying that's the fact. I'm saying that's what's going on. But the part of the people that are missing out is that pretty much every skill, pretty much every ability is replicable. So what an American can do, I can do probably in Latin America. What a West European can do, I can probably learn in East Europe. And so with this democratization of education, with this globalization and access to the internet and information, there is very little still in the 21st century, in 2019, that is not replicable, that's not replaceable. And I would also, I don't want to disagree with you, Chris, but I would say that generalizing this, you know, behavior of Western societies is really doing a disservice to the you know, the well-intended people in this area of the world. I'm actually here on a scholarship, a very generous scholarship from the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the UK. And by the way, applications are closing on November 5th. And so if anyone's listening in, make sure that you take a look at it, chevening.org. But like I said, you know, it's a process. You know, we've made great strides and we've got a long way to go. But we should not be looking at this as in a pessimistic view, from a pessimistic angle. We should draw from the lessons that we've learned over hundreds of years and build on that progress.
So when you take, I was taking a country like Canada, for example, and I was trying to look at the composition of the immigrants in the country, and it says that they have a lot of Asians in Canada. And we know Canada is one of the most richest country. So, and then you take Qatar, for example. I think one interesting thing I heard was that the Qataris themselves are less than 40% of the country's entire population. But then Qatar too is one of the most richest countries that we could find. So when you look at some of these countries where immigrants, they have lots of immigrants, but the country is still thriving, their economy is growing and everything. And then you come to maybe a country like a UK that actually took over 25% of the whole world when you talk about colonization and, you know, control of resources of the country. Why do you think at a point in time people would feel that they have something that they want to protect for their, just their citizens, when that thing really was, whichever success that they have that they want to protect was driven by their forefathers' ability to go to other countries to bring those resources in? So I think Junior, you add, then Sarah will talk.
On that, you are very right. For example, the British Empire was built on colonization of other countries. They started from South America, and then they moved to the North America, where obviously America, the current United States, was a British colony, and then he was able to gain independence. Nigeria, the whole West Africa was all British colony. India was a British colony. And it is something that kind of repeat itself historically. If you look at Apple right now, Apple is being assembled in China. And basically, obviously, the Apple industry believe that those jobs are no longer to be available in the USA. They should be available in China because obviously they are less expensive. So we human beings, we are always driven to gain access to cheaper resources, to gain access to more and more wealth.
But my question is, why should Apple send their stuff to Asia at a point when they feel like it's cheaper there? So why don't they just do it in their country? Why is that particular race, like I'm talking about races in Asia, a source of cheap labor to produce your stuff? But then when they are coming to your country to come and work, it becomes an issue. So why are you taking advantage of them and then they can't take advantage of
you? Which is a very negative thing. It is something that obviously the current global policies needs to look into. That is why we are even discussing nationalism, patriotism and racism, because it is something that, for example, I would like to take something from you, but I don't want you to take it back from me. You know, it's something that we don't live in an equal society. We don't live in an equal global, political and geopolitical policies. So, for example, Apple has the freedom to go to China, export Chinese labor, but at the same time, now Donald Trump is gearing war towards the Chinese economy with high tariff and everything. It's the same thing the British people has done. They have run all over the world, taking their wealth and bringing it to the British Empire. But right now, the British people believe that they have all the rights to defend their wealth and not allow other people to come and have access to it, which is not
Sarah,
right.
Yeah, sorry, wanted to.
So that's what capitalism and colonialism is all about. It's about theft. And we have a history of like 400 years now of resources being stolen from other lands and accrued in Britain. And the reason I would argue these attitudes still exist today is that people are like, we're socialized, like white British people are socialized to believe that those things are theirs. They don't know that, they don't know or they don't want to accept that they're stolen. And it's come up before. I know that Jeremy Corbyn mentioned it like last year, and I know it's something that people are discussing a lot more. To understand racism, especially in this country, we need to understand and acknowledge and confront the history of empire, and white people need to take responsibility for it. And there needs to be a redistribution of resources. We need to live in a more just, more equal, economically, socially society. But I think it starts from education about mm-hmm. our history, because mm-hmm. we cannot understand our present and we cannot move past these oppressions without understanding how they began. And they began with colonization. They began with capitalism.
I just want to add on that, because when they're teaching history in colleges and in school, they teach it positively. They believe that those things that had happened in the 400 or 1,000 years history of the Western world is a positive thing. Yeah. They believe that the transatlantic slave trade to America is a positive thing.
Yeah.
They believe that going to Nigeria, to Benin Empire, and stealing all their artworks. And there was an article, for example, they are urging the France, obviously, museum to return those artifacts to Nigeria, and they don't want to because they're all going to lose their jobs.
Yeah, I remember reading the article, and they said they finally gave it to the Nigeria, but they gave it to them on loan.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine?
The it's theirs.
Them. Yes.
It's Nigeria's.
Exactly, but they gave it to them on loan. And it actually brings out this, because I think you're talking about colonization and trade, because it was from one race to the other race. So my question is, now we realize that people have been socialized with certain values that makes them behave the way they do, and then sometimes it's just very difficult for them to even realize that they are being racist. So, like, starting from you, what do you think needs to change?
Well, I think in this case, change has to come both ways, both from the top down and then to the bottom up. And what I'm really, disappointed, that's the word I think, disappointed is to see a social regression in our politics, in the Western world politics, and the politics of many areas of the world, where you see this extreme right-wing movements taking over, and you see, again, I don't want to go so far as to use the word racism, but it is, and it's back on the table, and it's socially acceptable in many forms. And whether it's implicit or directly driven or expressed, it's really disappointing. And so, to answer your question, I think we have to restore the values of embracing others, of accepting others, of understanding that life is not a zero-sum game. In order for you to win, I don't have to lose, and vice versa. We can both win. We can both benefit from this integrated world. I'm not going to go into the so far as to talk about colonialism. That was, of course, a bad time. But the world is much different now, and we got to build again on that progress that has been made.
I'm sorry, like, looking at the way countries now are behaving like businesses, where it looks like we are competing, the people, citizens are demanding certain things from their governments, understanding that their governments can only do that when they oppress some other people elsewhere. How can we restore the values that Abada is talking about?
Well, I guess it might be cynical. It is cynical, probably, but I would kind of have to disagree that I think we ever had those values. I feel very skeptical about the idea that there's something that we need to return to, because I think that, I don't think that, like, for example, the Obama government or the Bush government was particularly great. They were running colonial projects in Iraq and, still had ties with the arms trade in Israel and Saudi Arabia, etc. And I think that racist microaggressions and stuff still perpetuated in those times. So I personally don't feel like we need to go back and restore something that was lost. I think that we need to move forward and find something new. And I think part of that is about understanding our past. And I mentioned earlier that I do think it's essential for people to understand the history of colonialism. And then I think we need to have a revolution because capitalism isn't working.
It looks like somebody is trying to disagree, but I think everything is still relating to how the role it is playing in racism at the moment, that sometimes it makes it very difficult. And then, I mean, sometimes too, the fact that we are being educated, exactly the content of our education is also shaping our thinking and our reactions to some of these things, not letting you know how racist certain things are or how we are really preparing your mind to just move on and forget about history. So, Gina, what do you have to say?
Like, that is very, very valid point, because I had the privilege to be taught the Western history in my high school and college. And the way it is taught, it is assume as if it is a good thing. It is not a good thing. So they have to change curriculum. They have to make the kids, the youngsters, the teenagers understand that all those things that happen weren't good stuff. They weren't good. So they have to change it. They have to change their mindset. They have to make them to understand that we are all equal, no matter where you are from, whether you're from Africa, whether you're from America, Latin, North, whether you're from South Asian, whether you're from China, Japan, we are all equal. We are all human beings. And as he said, as you said as well, government runs as business. People demand too much from the government, and the people need to realize that the government can provide everything. And the government, obviously, they are trying their best, obviously, and politics is running as a business, and obviously people are trying to get themselves elected, getting votes, making false promises, and it's all about how can I say? It is not inclusive. It is not about, as we are doing, try to converse, like
to have a chat
to have a chat and come to with positive conclusion. It is all about conflict, all about confrontation. It is all about I am right, you are wrong. It is all about left and right. We don't need that anymore.
Well, somebody can say that. It comes from how one is being socialized, and so when your brain has been made or architectured in a particular way, it wouldn't just take 2 hours of debate with someone else to change it. But I think because we are running out of time, the question I want to ask right now is, right now we've talked about some of the issues around this. What do you think should be the definition of nationalism, to the extent that it wouldn't cause people to feel like they are either superior to another race or something? So what should be your definition of nationalism, and what should be your definition of racism?
Well, nationalism, in a sentence, I guess, would be just this closing up, this isolationist view of the world, that you have to protect your interests against the interests of all others. You have to protect your economic, political, and social interests. And racism, was that your question?
Right now, after our discussion, what should be your definition of racism? What should be your definition of nationalism?
Yeah, well, the nationalist I gave you...
It's like a way of advice and...
Well, again, my advice would be, because I guess we have a predominantly young and student audience, I guess just speak to your classmate, whoever you think looks different from you. Just talk to them. Learn about their culture. Learn about how much they have to offer you. Learn about your history. Understand where you're coming from. Understand, like my colleagues have said, Sarah, Christopher, you, Kwame, what exactly is the root of your success story, quote unquote, and how can you make a better future? Because your children and grandchildren will be the victims or the beneficiaries of the right or wrong decisions that we as a generation make today in our world.
Great. So, Sarah.
No pressure. I would echo a lot of those sentiments, and I do think a huge part of it is that I would advise people to educate themselves and to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because these conversations, they're not comfortable, but that's okay, and it's okay to mess up and learn and grow, because we're all doing that, so it's fine. And in terms of nationalism, personally, I don't know if it will ever happen, but personally, I don't believe in borders, because to kind of echo what was said before, to me, I think nationalism, I think borders, I think isolating yourself, cutting yourself off. And I said before that I think that borders are violent. So really, I would think of my politics as... I don't want to say transcending nationalism, because that sounds really pompous, I don't even really want to say anti-national, because that also... we shouldn't have nations, is my opinion.
Exactly, yeah, Junior.
On this, you can read my post if you're there listening. You can read my post at blackpostjournal.com. I talk about nationalism, racism, and patriotism. on this, after this debate, and as well in my post, you can read it. You can research as well. Anderson talks about nationalism. It talks about imagined community. So my own definition of nationalism is that a nation is an imagined community. It's not something that is primordial. It is not something that is based on your color. It is not based on your identity. It is not based on your views. A nation is just something that we have. It is a human made. It's not something natural. So yeah. People just have to accept that. And the only thing that we can just move forward is just accepting each other and just be happy. So
yeah, that's great. And I think my definition of nationalism is that being proud that other people came to your country and they felt so happy. And it felt so nice to coexist with you in there. That is what I feel proud to say. I'm British, I'm Ghanaian, because when other people come in, I make them feel like the way I want them to be, like happy, nice, and everything. So thank you very much for coming to share
Thank you.
Thoughts. And I think your opinions are fantastic. And like I said, it is your opinion and no one else's opinion. And that is what people want to hear. So thank you, Christopher. Thank you, Sarah.
Luis.
Yeah. South America.
Where?
Middle East and Africa. Thank you so much. And you listen to this song by Wuta. It's called Burning Desire. So until next time, next week, Gen Second Radio.